Good day, everyone, and welcome to the Pebblebrook Hotel Trust second quarter 2013 earnings call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Raymond Martz, Chief Financial Officer. You may begin, sir.
Thank you, Lisa. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to our second quarter 2013 earnings call and webcast. Joining me today is Jon Bortz, our Chairman and Chief Executive Officer. Before we start, let me remind everyone that many of our comments today are considered forward-looking statements under federal securities laws. These statements are subject to numerous risks and uncertainties as described in our 10-K for 2012 and our other SEC filings and could cause future results to differ materially from those expressed in or implied by our comments. Forward-looking statements that we make today are effective only as of today, July 26, 2013, and we undertake no duty to update them later. You can find our SEC reports and our earnings release, which contain reconciliations of the non-GAAP financial measures we use on our website at pebblebrookhotels.com. Okay, the good news is we have another solid quarter to talk about. We're very pleased with our second quarter operating performance, which slightly exceeded our expectations. Same-property RevPAR for the total portfolio climbed 6% to $195. This was at the top end of our outlook for RevPAR growth of 5%-6%, primarily due to strong business and leisure transient demand and better-than-expected performance at many of our West Coast properties. In addition, we continue to see steady inbound international demand, which benefits many of our hotels, given our high concentration of high-quality hotels in many urban gateway locations. Our overall same-property RevPAR gains in the quarter came primarily from growth in rate. Our 6% RevPAR increase was driven by a 4.4% increase in ADR, while occupancy increased 1.5% to 86%, demonstrating the pricing power in the portfolio and the very high occupancy levels we've already achieved with majority of our markets above prior peak occupancy levels. As a reminder, RevPAR and hotel EBITDA results are same property beginning with our date of ownership and include all the hotels we owned as of June 30th, whether we own them or not in the prior year period. We don't exclude hotels under renovation from our RevPAR and hotel EBITDA results. In addition, our results reflect 49% of the performance of the Manhattan Collection, mirroring our joint venture ownership percentage. For our portfolio on a monthly basis, April RevPAR increased a very strong 12.5%, benefiting from the holiday shift. May was up 5.1%, and June, as expected, was weaker, rising only 1.3%, up against a very difficult comparison from last June. Recall that June benefited last year with lots of business moving into the month from July due to July 4th falling on a Wednesday. RevPAR growth in the quarter was led by Hotel Zetta, increasing 92.5%, as we've had a great response from the market to our very creative design and new high-quality product following our comprehensive renovation and repositioning that was completed this spring. Other RevPAR leaders in the quarter included Sir Francis Drake, Vintage Plaza Portland, Monaco Seattle, Palomar San Francisco, The Argonaut San Francisco, and InterContinental Buckhead. At the Affinity at 50, RevPAR declined by over 40% in the quarter from the comprehensive $18 million-$20 million renovation and repositioning, which continues to be on budget, with substantial completion expected as scheduled by the fourth quarter. The substantial RevPAR decline at Affinity at 50 negatively impacted our same-property RevPAR growth for the portfolio by 130 basis points in the quarter. Compared to last year, second quarter same-property total revenues increased 5.6%, and expense growth was limited to 4.2%, resulting in a same-property EBITDA margin increase of 93 basis points. EBITDA margin growth was reduced by 41 basis points and would have risen 134 basis points without Affinity at 50, which is more indicative of our overall success in continuing to drive margins upward. As a result of our solid RevPAR growth of 6% and EBITDA margin growth of 93 basis points, our total portfolio generated $46.1 million of same-property hotel EBITDA, an 8.8% increase over the second quarter of last year. This strong growth was achieved despite the negative impact experienced at several of our hotels undergoing a renovation during the quarter, including the Affinity at 50. EBITDA at Affinity at 50 declined 88% in the quarter, which reduced our same-property EBITDA growth rate by 241 basis points. The hotel EBITDA percentage growth leaders in the second quarter were Hotel Zetta, Sir Francis Drake, Vintage Plaza Portland, Palomar San Francisco, Hotel Monaco Seattle, Sheraton Delfina, and Mondrian L.A. 12 properties grew EBITDA more than 15% in the quarter compared to the same period last year. As a result of the solid hotel operating performance during the quarter, as well as a greater number of properties this year versus last, we generated adjusted EBITDA of $42.8 million for the quarter, an increase of $9.9 million or 30% compared to last year's second quarter results. Our adjusted FFO climbed to $26.4 million or 43 cents per share, compared with $20.1 million in the second quarter of 2012 or 37 cents per share, a 14.8% increase. Year-to-date, same-property RevPAR increased 7.2%, same-property EBITDA has climbed 10.8%, EBITDA margin is up 121 basis points, and adjusted EBITDA is up 38% or $18 million versus last year. Without Affinity 50, year-to-date RevPAR is up 8.2%, same-property EBITDA has increased 12.9%, and EBITDA margin has risen 154 basis points. Now, let's shift our focus to our capital investment and capital market activities in the second quarter. During the second quarter, we invested $11.7 million into our hotels as part of our capital reinvestment program, which included completing our renovations at Hotel Zeta, Sofitel Philadelphia, and the Affinity in Manhattan, as well as the ongoing renovation of Affinity 50. Year-to-date, we've invested over $28 million into our hotels as part of our capital reinvestment programs. On the debt side, in early April, we successfully completed a five-year, $50 million non-recourse loan at a fixed interest rate of 3.14%, secured by the Affinity Dumont in New York. The Dumont is part of the six-property Manhattan collection, which we own a 49% interest in with our joint venture partner, the Denihan Hotel Group. On the equity side, on April 11th, we announced that our underwriters exercised the green shoe for our Series C 6.5% preferred equity offering that we completed in late March. As a result, we raised a total of $100 million of preferred equity from the Series C offering. In addition, during the quarter, we raised $4.7 million in net proceeds through our ATM program at an average share price of $28.09. As of June 30th, we had cash, cash equivalents, and restricted cash of $165.4 million, plus another $12.6 million in unconsolidated cash, cash equivalents, and restricted cash from our 49% pro rata interest in the Manhattan Collection. I'd now like to turn the call over to John to provide a little color on the recently completed quarter, as well as our outlook for the remainder of 2013. John?
Thanks, Ray. So as Ray said, the second quarter was another terrific quarter for Pebblebrook. We benefited from a solid quarter of industry fundamentals and an ability to drive outperformance through the high occupancy levels of our properties and our markets. When we look at the second quarter's overall industry trends, performance continued to be driven by strength in transient travel, both business and leisure. Demand in the U.S. rose a healthy 2.1% in the quarter, and with little supply growth at just 0.8%, industry occupancy grew another 1.3%. This provided the foundation for ADR to grow a healthy 3.6%, resulting in a RevPAR increase of 5%, the 13th straight quarterly increase in industry RevPAR of 5% or more. At Pebblebrook, our West Coast properties significantly outperformed our properties located along the East Coast. RevPAR at our hotels located in Seattle, Portland, San Francisco, West LA, and San Diego grew 11% in the quarter, with occupancy up 3.3% to 84.8%, and ADR climbing a very strong 7.5%. On the East Coast, excluding Affinity 50, our properties in Boston, New York City, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., Buckhead, and Miami grew RevPAR by 3.2%, with occupancy up 1.3%, to an even stronger 89%, yet ADR increased just 1.9%. If we look a little more closely at the individual markets and their performance in the quarter, it highlights the ongoing fundamental strength and better psychology of the West Coast cities compared to the East Coast markets. On the West Coast, RevPAR in Seattle's CBD increased 10.6% in the second quarter. In San Francisco's urban market, RevPAR climbed 17.1%. Hollywood, Beverly Hills market, 6%. Santa Monica, 6.8%, and downtown Portland, 15.1%. San Diego, the one-week market on the West Coast, was up just 1.1%, struggling with a less attractive convention calendar in the year and a mayor who has created a situation where millions of tourism marketing dollars, which are already being collected, are not currently being spent. By comparison, on the East Coast, downtown Miami RevPAR increased 4.3%, though up a much stronger 12.4% year-to-date. Downtown Boston was flat in the quarter. Buckhead was our best market on the East Coast, with RevPAR increasing 7.6%. Washington, D.C.'s CBD, struggling with government cutbacks, was up just 2.2%. Philadelphia's CBD, 1%, and Manhattan rose 3.4%. And please keep in mind, these statistics are for the urban markets described, not the metropolitan markets or our individual properties. While transient business led the way in our portfolio, our group business performed well in the quarter. Group revenue rose 4.4%, with ADR up 3.2%. Transient revenue grew 6.5% in the quarter, with ADR increasing 4.7%. Group represented 25% of our room nights in the quarter. Transient made up 75%. Year-to-date, this breakdown is the same, and we expect this 75-25 segmentation to remain roughly the same for the rest of 2013. Now let me talk a little bit about EBITDA growth and margins. As we reported, same property portfolio revenues grew 5.6%. Same property EBITDA grew 8.8%, and same property EBITDA margin rose 93 basis points. As Ray mentioned, without Affinia 50 and its significant impact from its renovation, same property revenues grew 6.5%, same property EBITDA grew 11.2%, and EBITDA margin climbed 134 basis points, or 41 basis points better without Affinia 50. On a same property basis, we limited the growth in operating cost to 4.2%, even with a 1.5% increase in occupancy and a 14.7% increase in property taxes, which continued to be negative impacted for 1 year by the automatic reassessments of our recently acquired California hotels, including W. Westwood, Palomar San Francisco, and Embassy Suites San Diego. Property taxes at these properties alone reduced our EBITDA margin growth by 20 basis points. These results highlight the success we continue to have working closely with our operators, identifying and implementing our best practices. As of today, we've now identified over $16 million of cost savings and enhancements. We expect this process of identifying and then implementing and then annualizing these EBITDA and margin enhancements will continue for several years to come. Our margins are far below stabilized margins for our portfolio, and in addition, as we acquire hotels with significant opportunities to improve subpar performance, we refill the pipeline of higher EBITDA and margin growth for future years. So let me provide a quick update on our property renovations. During the quarter, two properties were undergoing significant renovations that had a material negative impact on their performance. The largest of them all, the comprehensive renovation, reconfiguration, an expansion of Affinia 50 began in January, and as Ray mentioned, continues to be on schedule and without any budget surprises. We've now taken out of service all of the old rooms, and we've completed the renovation and put back in service 166 of the 210 rooms we started with. We should be back up to the original room count by early September, with the newly created additional 41 rooms coming back into inventory over the course of the remainder of the year as they're renovated and the new elevator is completed. We continue to be in a heavy phase of customer disruption as the extremely visible public areas, including the entrance, lobby, and second floor, are being renovated, with substantial completion expected by the beginning of the fourth quarter. We're very pleased that the newly renovated rooms have been extremely well received by not only the property's existing customer base, but by many potential new clients that have toured the new room product. We continue to be optimistic about the hotel's performance next year as a fully renovated, repositioned, and expanded hotel. The other major disruptive work in the quarter involved the completion of the last phase of the comprehensive renovation of the Affinia Manhattan. Specifically, the public areas were completed by early June and included the entrance, main lobby, and meeting space. We held a grand reintroduction party in late June, and the reception was extremely favorable. We're very encouraged by the opportunity for this property to gain back significant RevPAR penetration over the next couple of years and significantly grow its group base. And as we look out into 2014, as discussed last quarter, we don't see any major renovations within the existing portfolio that will be materially disruptive to the overall performance of the company, outside of the more minor impact of the comprehensive renovation at Vintage Park in Seattle, which is a small property, and the lobby, restaurants, and bars at W. Westwood, which will all be renovated and reconcepted. Now let me turn to a quick update on our outlook for 2013. We continue to expect 2013 to be a great year for both the industry and Pebblebrook. For the industry, we're maintaining our RevPAR growth range of 5 to 6.5%. For our portfolio, we're also making no change to our RevPAR growth range of 5.5 to 7%, with about 100 basis point negative impact from the renovation of Affinia 50 still being forecasted. Given the better than forecasted performance in the second quarter, we're raising the lower end of our range for same property EBITDA, adjusted EBITDA, and FFO by $1 million, reflecting our better than expected performance in Q2. The third quarter looks healthy based on current trends and business on the books. So we're forecasting RevPAR to increase by 5 to 6%, which reflects about 100 basis point negative impact from Affinia 50's renovation. For Q3, we're also forecasting EBITDA margin to grow by 25 to 50 basis points. Economic trends, travel trends, and business on our books continue to support our forecast of healthy growth for 2013. As of the end of June, total group and transient revenue on the books for the last two quarters of this year was up 10% over same time last year. Portfolio-wide, for the remaining 6 months of 2013, group room nights were up 4.4%, with group ADR up 1.3% for a total of 5.7%. Transient room nights on the books for the second half were higher by 5.6%, with transient rate up 7.4%, and total transient revenues on the books for the last 6 months higher by 13.5%. To wrap up, we continue to expect 2013 to be another terrific year for the lodging industry and an even better year for Pebblebrook. Underlying fundamentals remain healthy. With the completion of all of our renovations, we've got tremendous opportunity in the existing portfolio to recapture significant RevPAR lost in prior years and dramatically improve margins through the implementation of best practices and lots of focus and hard work by our operators and our team. And quarter after quarter, we expect to continue to be successful executing on both of these major opportunities. So that completes our prepared remarks. We'd now be happy to answer whatever questions that you might have. Operator?
Thank you, sir. If you'd like to ask a question on the phone lines today, you can press star 1 on your telephone. Again, everyone, that is star 1 to ask a question. Also, if you are on a speakerphone, please make sure your mute option is turned off before pressing your signal. We'll take our first question from Bill Crow with Raymond James.
Hey, good morning, John, Ray, everybody. John, could you address, you know, this lull that we've seen over the last 6-8 weeks, and in particular maybe dive a little bit deeper into the group business and what you're seeing as the driver for some of the weakness that you may not necessarily be seeing, but we certainly are?
Sure. Well, Bill, I think, you know, the lull seems terribly familiar with the lull that we had experienced last year from July through maybe November. Whether it's based upon, you know, the political activities early in the year, the fiscal headwinds, it's hard to say. But it just continues to reflect, I think, the bumpy recovery that we continue to experience in the economy, particularly as we've seen, you know, economic growth in the first half, particularly here in the second quarter, to be pretty weak. I think it's being probably more impacted by group than it is by transient travel. And I think the group, at least in our view, likely reflects three negative impacts this year. One of which is, and I think we've spoken about it since late last year, you know, we have a weaker overall convention calendar in the U.S. in 2013 compared to 12, particularly in a lot of the major markets. So I think that provides a certain difficulty from a comparison perspective. The second negative impact is government. Government has instituted lots of new rules about how they allow meetings, how meetings get approved, and who has to approve them. And there's significant reductions in overall spending for meetings as a result of cutbacks in overall government spending across the board and as a result of sequestration. So, you know, we're seeing, we believe, likely a significant cut or reduction in government meetings in the D.C. market. We think anecdotally it's about 50%. And probably a bit less than that on a national basis. And the third, I think, negative impact on group is this sort of lull in or slowdown in growth in both corporate profits in the first half of this year, as well as the growth, a slowdown in the growth of corporate revenues. And so we think that's, you know, restraining some group spending on the part of corporations, and we continue to see restraint on the part of corporations as it relates to, you know, high spend incentive travel meetings, and sort of rah-rah culture meetings. And as we've stated previously, we don't think that's really going to change until we see more competition for people in those key industries, such as the financial industries.
And with all those headwinds, I think you said second half group bookings are up 5%+ in your portfolio, I think, in your prepared remarks. What has that trend been doing? Have you seen more cancellations than additions, or is there upside to that 5% number? Where do you think that goes?
My guess is it might go down some, Bill. We've seen probably slightly weaker shorter-term bookings. Certainly in the second quarter we did than what we'd seen previously, particularly beginning in May and June. So I think it might go down a little bit from the numbers that we're at, particularly on the occupancy side. And you can see by the strength in our transient numbers that, you know, that's clearly making up for the overall numbers. So we still feel pretty good about the second half of the year. And I think, you know, perhaps others others who have a broader reach in the industry can probably give you a little more guidance on the overall outlook, because I think we have, with such a small portfolio, particularly small number of sort of group-focused houses, you know, I don't think we're particularly representative of the industry.
Yeah, fair enough. One final question for me. The 4.2% increase in operating expenses, and you I think, attributed 20 basis points to the rise in property taxes from California. Is that sort of 4% number a good way to think about next year, or are you starting to think about health care costs or other issues that might bump it up from there?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think, you know, our view is we think of sort of core expense growth at around 3%, and that's probably higher made up of a higher percentage in labor and benefits and a lower percentage in other. Now, those expenses will go up or down based upon what happens with overall revenues, obviously, particularly growth in non-room revenues, and of course, growth in occupancies. Now, for us, you know, outside of the renovated properties and probably Zeta in the portfolio, there's not a whole lot of occupancy growth that we're really driving towards in the rest of the portfolio. And you can see that with the 86% that we ran in the quarter for the overall portfolio. And I think we had 21 out of 26 properties in excess of 80% for the year. So I think most of the increase is going to come from rate and other revenues. And but there's still lots of costs that come along with that. And so, you know, we think flow, you know, is going to continue to be for those somewhere in the 60 to 70% for ADR, and clearly for food and beverage and other, you know, the flow tends to be far less than that because food and beverage is often volume and not price increases.
Okay. Thanks for the color, John.
Our next question comes from Ian Weissman with ISI Group.
Yes, good morning. Just a quick question on deals. I mean, there's been a lot of concern in the marketplace. You know, management teams have been getting questions about backup and cap rates given what the 10-year's done. You guys are very active in on the deal side. Maybe you could just talk a little bit about what you're seeing in cap rates and underwriting and whether or not investors are changing assumptions at this point.
Sure. I think what we're seeing in the market in general is the opposite of what perhaps the theory of higher interest rates would cause, or at least what you'd think it would cause. We've seen, you know, we're driven as much or more by the supply of capital in the industry than we are with interest rates, and particularly in a business, and we are a business that has very strong fundamental growth inherent in it for at least the next few years. And so it's not a fixed income stream that folks are buying, which maybe interest rates would have a bigger impact on. So we've actually seen an increase in the amount of competition for deals. We've seen greater aggressiveness in the gateway markets from both REITs and private equity. We're seeing even more aggressiveness in properties that have brand or management available as operators or brands hook up with private equity where there's more capital available and where there's higher leverage available in the debt markets, even with what is a temporary shutdown or slowdown in the CMBS markets due to the Treasury volatility. So we've seen cap rates in the gateway markets, particularly the West Coast markets, probably decline by upwards of 100 basis points in the last 90 days. And in many cases, that's dropping cap rates below 6, well below 6. We've seen some deals go for sub 5. In some of those markets, and you know, for us, it means that we're going to remain disciplined to achieve the returns that we feel comfortable with that adds value for the firm, and because we already have a particularly a heavy representation on the West Coast, we don't feel any strategic need, you know, to add properties and EBITDA in markets that we might otherwise be underrepresented in. So I think, you know, the overall markets, and maybe, Ian, some of it is capital coming from other sectors. We've seen some interesting players in New York where I would describe them as core institutional investment funds or groups, which don't historically invest in lodging, have come into lodging and made investments. And honestly, that always scares me when we see core players come into the space, because oftentimes they're late.
Mm-hmm. That's helpful. And finally, last question. You gave very good detail on specific markets comparing the East Coast and the West Coast. I imagine the East Coast continues to suffer, because in part supply issues, too. I imagine it's a bit government-related. But if you think about, without giving, I guess, guidance for next year, do you think that trend can reverse itself next year, or would you say that the West Coast will continue to outperform longer term because of maybe its supply is the bigger driver, but do you think that trend can continue next year?
I do think it'll continue for next year. I think our view is that, next year the economies will likely continue to be a little bit better on the West Coast than the East Coast. There's very little to no supply in the West Coast markets arriving next year or the year after. And I think, we'll continue to face supply issues in New York. And we have a supply issue in D.C. for next year with the new convention hotel opening in April, or at least forecasted to open in April. I think some of that will be offset by the fact that we have some better convention calendars on the East Coast, in Boston in particular, in D.C., as well, in Atlanta as well. So that headwind will be somewhat offset by, a better group and convention market.
Just given that, you talked to mentioned before about the compression in cap rates in the lodging sector, and given some of your concerns that you're addressing, could you see Pebblebrook selling assets over the next 12 months to reposition the portfolio?
Yeah, I don't, there's this, we kind of look at things in sort of a buy, hold, sell period, and forecast out each year. We go through an analysis and compare, and I guess I would describe it as a little like getting an offer you can't refuse. To the extent it gets meaningfully out of whack compared to the growth rates and the opportunity, particularly for properties where we're fixing operations and physical attributes of the properties that'll lead to much higher growth, which a buyer might not necessarily pay for, I'd say we're probably more likely in a hold period, particularly for more of our perpetual markets. And we'll look more closely next year at some of the non-perpetual market properties. And we'll be focused on both what values are and what cap rates are doing there, and also what supply looks like and the underlying economic environment in each of the individual markets. So we'll take a case-by-case review of our assets, and it's certainly possible that we might sell some, particularly some of our non-perpetual assets next year.
Okay, thanks so much.
Our next question comes from Andrew Didora with Bank of America.
Hi, good morning, John. Good morning, Ray. Just a little bit of a follow-up to Ian's earlier question on the transaction market. John, in the past, your comments, it seems like you've been a little bit, been factoring in a bit more risk into some of your underwriting, whether it's coming from, increased supply in New York or maybe some weaker group compression. When you think about how you're underwriting properties now, have you started to factor in any sort of recession in your five-year models yet? And I guess, have you changed your exit cap rate assumptions on your current underwriting much, given the future rate expectations?
So two things. One is we haven't changed the way we underwrite in general. We analyze, the macro environment, the micro market, and then the individual property, and base our underwriting based upon all of those factors. Two, we've wanted to underwrite conservatively with cushion, and because we screw up from time to time, and things don't exactly turn out the way we think they're going to turn out in any of those three pieces, the macro, the micro, or the individual property. sometimes they take longer to achieve our objectives as well. So we haven't changed our desire to have a cushion. We have not built in a recession yet. And as soon as we do, you can expect that that'll just price us out of the market immediately. And then as it relates to cap rates, we've been utilizing cap rates anywhere from 7 to 7.5 on the back end. And so I think, you know, just as we don't use marginal cost of capital to underwrite, we use long-term cost of capital. We also use what we believe would be, you know, more middle or late cycle cap rates. Although I would tell you that at least in the last two cycles that I've experienced, we never did see cap rates rise later in the cycle as in theory they should, as both growth rates decline and you are much closer to any cyclical downturn, and two, interest rates typically go up. So, you know, from our viewpoint, we feel comfortable that what we were underwriting is still appropriate for what we are underwriting today, and you know, that'll lead to whether or not we win deals and can achieve the spread on our cost of our long-term cost of capital that'll add value for the shareholders.
That's helpful, John. I guess that's kind of why I asked the question, because your deal activity has taken a bit of a pause lately, so I didn't know if you were kind of underwriting any, you know, change your underwriting assumptions at all, you know, relative to the next buyer out there. But just, you know, in terms of the reason for the pause in your deal activity, is it because of the more competition that you were referring to earlier, or are you just not seeing the types of assets in the markets that you're targeting like you've seen in the past?
No, I think the volume of opportunities in the market is, you know, similar to what it was in the second half of last year. So there's a reasonable number of properties we have an interest in the gateway markets. I would say our success rate has declined on particularly competitive transactions due to the competition and the way others are underwriting. And look, we don't, you know, the interesting thing about our space is, you know, what our view of the future is in a market or for an asset may be very different than somebody else. And so we may be wrong. They may very well be more accurate. And it may turn out that we were too conservative and maybe we should have been willing to pay more on transactions. Only time will tell. The one thing we can look at, you know, with the way we underwrite compared to what's going on in the markets, is we can look at, you know, how are things occurring with the assets we've already bought compared to what we've underwritten. And while we've been exceeding what we've underwritten, it's not by a monstrous margin. And so as a result of that, we feel good that we're, you know, we're being appropriately conservative. You know, our sense, at least by our underwriting, and again, similar approach, you know, we think we've seen unlevered IRRs drop into the low nines for gateway properties. And, you know, given the environment and where we are in the cycle and the fact that, you know, cost of capital is likely, at least marginal cost of capital is likely to have risen for other folks, you know, we think that's pretty aggressive and generally unattractive from our viewpoint.
Thank you. That's helpful. One final one for me, kind of changing gears a little bit, just on the Delfina asset. You know, maybe give us a little bit of a background on how you came about to choose the Le Méridien brand over any other brand or even an independent brand. Did Starwood offer anything, you know, anything to you here in order to stay within their brand family?
Sure. So when we bought that asset, if you recall, what we said was the franchise agreement was going to be up in the fall of 2013, so later this fall. And, you know, we would analyze, you know, a multitude of scenarios from keeping it a Sheraton to rebranding it to making it independent. And what we told you is exactly the same conversation we had with Starwood. And so as really over the last 12 months, as we finished the renovation there, as we've been able to see how the property performs in the market, where it's successful, where there's opportunity, we really came down to two scenarios that we looked at, that we analyzed in great detail and compared. And one of those was making it independent, which or small brand, which obviously we feel comfortable with, and two, upbranding it with Starwood. I think we came to the conclusion that property in that market as a Sheraton is just leaving too much on the table from an opportunity perspective and upside perspective. And so, you know, we ended up comparing Meridian, which we ultimately selected, to independent. And I would tell you that it was a very, very difficult decision. The numbers are very, very close. There are benefits of both. There are risks of both. And where we ended up was with Meridian, and we did not analyze other brands. And in fact, that was a discussion we had with Starwood that, based upon the relationship we had, we really didn't want to pit them against other brands. We just feel like our relationship with our existing brands and operators in our existing situations is too important to us. And so they were either going to win it as a Meridian or they were going to lose it as an independent. And, you know, and so we ended up with Meridian. You know, in terms of the arrangement that we negotiated, you know, we had alternatives. So, you know, you can come to your own conclusions about what that means, but we feel very good about the overall transaction and the opportunity to really take advantage of what we think is a lot of upside in a very strong market where our rate is $80 to $100 lower than properties a couple of blocks away, obviously closer to the beach, which making it a Meridian doesn't get us any closer to the beach. But I think it does provide in the market a view of an upper upscale brand versus the view of an upscale brand, which Sheraton represents.
Okay, that's great. All for me. Thank you.
We'll take our next question from Jeff Donnelly with Wells Fargo Securities.
Good morning, guys. Ray, I got to say, though, until now I never realized that Brian Adams' song was really an anthem for a shareholder-friendly corporate posture. So thank you for that. actually, John, if I could just stick on the Sheraton Delfina, I'm just curious, do you expect much disruption from that conversion? And I know oftentimes when we see an upbranding, you see an increase in rate. What is that going to do to the expense load and margin by going more upscale with that hotel?
Yeah, I think we're going to spend some dollars, obviously, to make a conversion. The good news is it's not that much considering, you know, we just spent $9 million renovating the property with the idea that, you know, it would continue to be an upper upscale quality property with high design and high style, probably a bit inconsistent to some extent with what Sheraton represents as a brand. And that's part of, you know, probably what was limiting some of our upside as a Sheraton. So the cost will be slightly higher, although, again, we've been running it as really a four-diamond quality upper upscale hotel. Isn't a material change in cost base, and in fact, in some cases, there are fewer services. We don't need to have a separate club room for Starwood guests and the costs that go along with that, which were an obligation of the Sheraton brand, but not of the Meridian brand. From a disruption perspective, Jeff, it should be fairly small. As a result of any physical changes, what we're doing is primarily signage, artwork, a few changes from an FF&E perspective, and then, you know, probably the most significant work would relate to making improvements to the bar off the lobby, which is a separate space. And so I think the disruption would relate more to just the change of flag. And the good news is it's in the Starwood system. We do a lot of Starwood loyal guest business at the hotel. We do a lot of corporate, corporate accounts at the hotel in that Santa Monica market. And so we think that business is likely to stay. We may lose some Sheraton core customers, but hopefully over time we'll replace that with much higher paying Meridian or upper upscale customers.
I think the other bigger benefit is we have this wonderful set of meeting space, including a ballroom on the top of the hotel with, you know, terrific views of Santa Monica and the Pacific Ocean. And I think, you know, unfortunately in the, you know, the high end Santa Monica and West End markets, Sheraton just isn't the brand of choice for weddings and bar mitzvahs and bat mitzvahs. And so we think the change to Meridian, along with the improvements we already made in terms of upgrading the quality of that space, should help drive significantly more food and beverage into the hotel.
And you mentioned how the rate stacks up against some of the beachfront hotels. I mean, if my memory serves me correct, I think this is one of the only Starwood products pretty much west of the 5 over in Santa Monica. I think, like, the W Hollywood, I think, is one of the closest hotels. You know, do you think that's relevant in terms of how you price off of them? I mean, how do you think about where you can ultimately end up?
Yeah, I think one of the considerations in staying in the Starwood system versus any other system and or making it independent is exactly what you describe, is that they have little to no representation in that market, and obviously it was very important to them to maintain distribution in that marketplace. So it was certainly a big factor in the consideration, and certainly some of the bigger pluses, particularly when you think about a brand like Meridian, which doesn't yet have the recognition in the U.S. perhaps that it certainly has abroad.
And just maybe switching gears to build on maybe the prior line of questioning is, you know, I think going back a few years, maybe it was summer of 06, you had called for a sort of a peak in the lodging cycle that ultimately proved timely. If you had to look into your crystal ball for this cycle, can you predict when you think you'll make that same call again, you know, when you're going to start underwriting recessions into your putting it in your underwriting performance?
It's much harder in this cycle so far. And, you know, our sense is this is going to be, that this will continue to be a slower recovery. And the economy is likely to, because of that, probably see a longer recovery. And so the macro to us seems like it's more likely to be more similar to the two prior cycles before the two we just experienced. So more like the 80s and the 90s, where we saw more like a 9-year economic cycle versus 2000 and into the 2010s, where we saw more like 6-year economic cycles. But that's the macro, and obviously the one thing we learned with 9/11 or the financial crisis is there are events, you know, that could shorten that, and those are pretty impossible to predict. The micro side, you know, we've certainly bounced off the bottom of supply growth as an industry, and, you know, it obviously varies by market, but in general we're seeing, you know, a slow growth in supply coming back into the market. We think it too will be stretched out for some period of time, particularly since it really isn't supported in a lot of markets yet by the underlying economics. But we think we're likely to get to a point of neutrality between demand and supply by 2015, you know, at somewhere around 2% supply growth, 2% demand growth. If the economy is better, 15 will end up being a continuing year of occupancy growth. But we certainly think 14 is going to be strong. 15 should be very healthy. And, you know, 16 and beyond really depend upon how the macro plays out and how the capital markets for new construction play out.
How do you think that leads you to run your balance sheet from this point and run your acquisitions? Do you basically maybe step back from doing the acquisition redevelopment story so that you can allow some of the assets to season and allow your sort of debt to EBITDA to naturally or organically delever to that point?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're seeing that, Jeff, in that our acquisition volume has sort of continued to come down from the early years of Pebblebrook and the earlier years in the cycle. You know, we do tend to get more conservative with our growth outlook, and when others don't, you know, we tend to lose deals, and we're good with that. You know, we'd rather be general buyers in the early part of the cycle and the first half of the cycle than the second half of the cycle, and so, you know, you're seeing the result effectively occur as a result of our view on risk and growth and where we are in the cycle. And I think from a balance sheet perspective, you know, we'll continue to run the business very conservatively from a debt level, and we'll add the extra juice for the large amount of growth we have already in the portfolio through 2015 with the perpetual preferreds that we've layered over top. So, you know, we're sort of playing our approach to this strategically is, look, we're buying properties that have a lot of growth. We're not paying for that growth. Assuming we can execute and fix and improve these properties and improve their performance, we're going to drive very significant growth in top line and bottom line. And that'll lead to very significant growth in valuations due to the bottom line improvement. And we want to lever that more than the risk involved in debt through the addition of the perpetual preferred. So when you look at us on a debt to EBITDA basis, we're at the low end of our peer group. When you look at us as debt and preferred, we're in the middle of the peer group, maybe at the upper end of certainly the more conservative REITs, because we have so much value creation in the opportunity. We want that to go to the existing shareholders, and we can do that through the extra leverage from the perpetuals.
So, Paul, and just maybe one last question. You talked about group earlier in your comments, and I think the folks at Starwood yesterday were saying that group or corporate demand seems to be shifting towards smaller meetings away from sort of the big corporate gatherings. Is there an investment case to be made for small group hotels, you know, similar to those run by, say, like a Dolce? You know, what's your attitude, I guess, towards acquiring hotels maybe like those, like the Skamanias or the deal you once did in a prior life at Santa Cruz?
I guess I would generally say that, you know, we view there to be more risk in properties that have more group in the long term. And while I don't know that the trend that you just mentioned is a secular trend, our view is consistent with our view that a lot of this group won't come back until later in the cycle and when there's a lot more competition for people. And companies need to put on those larger cultural meetings and the higher paying incentive group travel. So, you know, our view is more risk with the big hotels. They're more complicated. They have more food and beverage components, particularly in the urban markets. While the food and beverage is interesting from a revenue perspective, based upon a lot of the union arrangements in those major markets, you really don't make any money. In fact, you can lose money. You can lose significant money on food and beverage, even banquet business in the major markets. And so, you know, we feel like we're kind of in the sweet spot. There's a price we'll pay for those assets, but we haven't been successful. And the other view, at least on the big properties, is, you know, we have such great diversification within the portfolio. We don't have any single asset that, you know, is going to dramatically swing or put at risk the performance of the portfolio. And so, you know, we've tended to, for risk reasons, shy away from some of the larger assets that have been on the market. In terms of small small properties with group, I mean, that's sort of where we are in our portfolio.
Okay. Thank you.
We'll take our next question from David Loeb with Baird.
Good morning. I wanted to just ask a little bit about pricing power and confidence in rate setting. What do you think changes that, particularly in the East Coast, over the next year?
I think more economic activity and less fiscal noise.
So do you think the government issue is a big part of that? Or do you think it's more...
I do. I think the noise out of D.C., the continuing uncertainty, while less compared to what it was, you know, there was a period in the first quarter running well into the second quarter where there was perhaps a lot of hope and excitement about tax reform, as an example. And, you know, it seems pretty clear to us based upon the increasing partisanship that's gone on that, you know, the likelihood of anything happening in tax reform, you know, has probably declined dramatically in the last 90 days. I mean, just look at the inability to get something so helpful and so pragmatic done in terms of immigration that's a nonpartisan issue in general. It's just amazing. So, you know, our sense is that you've got this fiscal drag for this year, and certainly you have some drag from the sequestration impact on the overall budgets that'll run through the first 4 months of next year. It seems to us that as that drag declines, economic activity is likely to pick up, and that should lead to, you know, more corporate investment, more growth, and more certainty on the part of the corporate America.
And how do you see group broadly impacting pricing power?
You know, it's interesting, David, because we have properties, quite a few properties in the portfolio, where because our transient rates are so much higher, because the markets are running at such high occupancy, that unless groups are willing to pay the rates that we're looking for, that we can get from alternative demand, we're just not taking it. And so I think it really varies by market. Clearly, to the extent we see growth in demand from group, I think that'll have a material impact overall on pricing, and it'll build a base for those who don't have it that right now are out there competing in the transient markets.
Okay, that's very helpful. One more. Miami, you said the CBD was up 4.3 in the quarter. That seems a little lighter than what it's been doing. Anything specific you see going on there?
There isn't anything specific. I mean, you know, you have this bumpiness in the economic growth in Latin America, and, you know, particularly in Brazil, where I think their forecasts for economic growth have moderated. And, you know, I think all of that, you know, more modest economic growth in Latin America impacts travel into Miami in particular. So while there's still, you know, healthy growth, it's just moderated a little bit. And as we get into the second quarter and then into the third here, where we run generally lower occupancies than we do in the first quarter, you know, you just don't have the same level of pricing power in that market that you had in the first quarter, as an example.
Okay, great, thanks.
We'll take our next question from Wes Golladay with RBC Capital Markets.
Hey, good morning, guys. Looking at the acquisition market, we did notice that you guys had a $3 million deposit, and we're kind of wondering what you're looking at. Will it be more of a core acquisition that you're seeing, or a value add, or maybe a full turn such as the Zeta?
We're looking at a hotel.
Okay. I guess for modeling purposes, any idea there? Or
We've always said just because of the relationship with sellers and the lack of 100% certainty on potential acquisitions that, you know, in general, our view is we'll let you know what it is when we buy it, and we'll give you, you know, all the detail about it when we do buy it. But, you know, you should presume it continues to be in the markets that we've targeted, in the markets we've been buying, and we continue to look for properties that have upside.
Okay, that's helpful. Now, you mentioned that you're turning away group in some markets. Has that expanded beyond San Francisco?
I would say, it'll depend on seasonality, Wes. So in markets like Seattle or Portland, where the transient rates in season can be significantly higher than group, that will be, you know, we are making decisions to trade off a group for transient in those markets in season. We've been doing it in LA, particularly at the W in Westwood, where, you know, we've cranked up our overall occupancies because of the strength of the market into the mid to upper 80s. And again, the groups are unwilling to pay what we can get from transient customers. And so our group is off, you know, meaningfully at that property. Not that it's a huge piece to begin with, but, you know, it's probably off at least a third, potentially a half this year, and it's all conscious on our part. It's just about taking business and revenue managing in a way that's going to give us the best performance.
Okay, and looking at, you know, you guys had strong EBITDA growth across the portfolio. Are you starting to get near where you have to pay incentive fees for your hotels?
Not really. I mean, we have gotten into incentive fees at two properties. Actually, one was just incentives from the day we bought it with an existing management arrangement, and we've only had one of the properties that we've acquired that have moved into an incentive fee basis, and it's because it's way, way far ahead of underwriting.
Okay, and Neil Malkin's here. He has one quick question for you guys.
Hey, gentlemen. Your Danny Hahn investment's been pretty significant, and as such, you know, has a big impact on EBITDA. Just a question, you know, how do you look at, booking or getting people to come to those hotels? I mean, I know it's New York and it's easy to get occupancy, but, you know, how do you get people to come or increase brand awareness to, you know, kind of boost or get the RevPAR index to its highest level?
Yeah, it really comes down to hiring the right people who understand how to get business. We have this funny thing in the business. We call these people salespeople. And, you know, for many of our branded properties, they tend to be order takers as opposed to salespeople. So for our small brands, our independent properties, it's really about PR. It's really about direct sales. It's about the Internet and getting exposure on the Internet, which has really leveled the playing field versus the big brands. I mean, the research that a customer can do today, the information they can get, not just from our websites, but from TripAdvisor or from Yelp or from Expedia or any of the sites that people look for third-party reviews, customer photos, all of that tends to eliminate uncertainty on the part of the traveling customer and a willingness to, you know, if you will, maybe take a risk that's no longer a risk and go to a property that they're not familiar with. If it's not branded. So, you know, what we find over time is, particularly in the urban markets, people are already coming to those markets. You don't need the brand to attract people into the market. Now we just need to get the business that's coming to the market. And we feel, we've been doing this now for 20 years on the independent side and the small brand side, and what we find is that, you know, we can be as competitive or more competitive, and we can do it at lower costs, and that means we make more money per key, which means we have more value per key,
and we have full flexibility to spend our sales and marketing and PR dollars as we wish. We're not stuck in corporate programs. We're not stuck in things that won't help us. We don't have to do things physically that we don't think is in the best interest of our property or our customers, which would otherwise need to fit and be consistent across a brand. So, you know, we feel very comfortable with both, and I think, you know, the decision we made in Santa Monica is a good example where we could have gone either way. It was pretty much a wash. We think a little better opportunity with Meridian in the market than independent, but we were very comfortable going as an independent property.
And Neil, whether it's a branded property or non-branded property, it's ultimately really critical that you have the right management team in place of the property. And that's what we've always focused on, and particularly with the Manhattan Collection. Half the general managers within the six hotels are new general managers that have done we've brought in some good teams and made some improvements there. So we're going through a lot of changes, and we're very encouraged with the direction. But this is all across all of our hotels. That's one of the, you know, things we always spend a lot of time focused on, the management team at the property level.
Okay, thanks.
We'll take our next question from Lucas Hartwich with Green Street Advisors.
Thank you. Hey, guys. John, Pebblebrook has been around for about 4 years now, and I'm just curious how things have played out versus your expectations. Is there anything that surprised you along the way?
Yeah, a couple things, Lucas. One is I think we were able to accumulate a larger number of assets of higher quality in overall better locations in major gateway markets than what we thought and what we told people when we went on our roadshow for the IPO back in December of 2009. So clearly, you know, we're much more excited about the quality of the portfolio. Second, I think we were able to find properties with even more opportunity than what we thought, both off market and on market, and with more upside that we could execute on. And so the kind of value creation opportunity is greater than what we thought it would be. And then finally, you know, not you know, something that's played out differently is, you know, while we underwrite on an unlevered basis, and we had a certain view of the debt and preferred capital markets when we went public, you know, those markets have turned out to be much more attractive than what we thought when we went public, and therefore we've been achieving the unlevered returns that we talked about on the roadshow or better, but our levered returns are better than that and better than what we thought they would be. So, you know, we're really excited about the way it's played out, and we think there's just great opportunity within the portfolio for several more years.
Great, thank you.
And there are no further questions. I would like to turn the conference back over to our speakers for any additional or closing remarks.
Thanks, operator, and thank you all for participating. And as our song says, we're here for you if you have questions. And so please feel free to give us calls if you have further information you're looking for. Otherwise, we look forward to talking with you and reporting next quarter.
And that concludes today's presentation. Thank you for your participation.